In an ever-changing world, we need to keep track of what will be next. Forward Thinkers is your 48 Forward podcast to discover the future. We are talking to innovative and creative minds from all over the world to learn more about what they are working on and what they think will change the way we work and live within the next decade. Are you ready to join the ride? Welcome to Forward Thinkers.
So, unfortunately, we only have 30 minutes today. Honestly, I'd like to sit here with both of you for 2 to 3 hours, but I think Daniel will be very mad at me and probably not invite me back here. So I'll stick to the 30 minutes. I'll try my very hardest, but we have a lot of issues to discuss. So I think we're just going to start with the status quo. And I'm going to start with you, General Heinius. Could you just maybe give us a broad overview? What are European defense capabilities like today? Where are we good at? Where are we making progress? Where are we lacking? And where are we still relying on the support of other NATO countries, especially the United States?
Thank you very much, Kerry. First of all, I regret that I am not in my best uniform, but it was so hot, so I took off my tie and my jacket. So you will have to excuse me for that, but I'm a Scandinavian, so I'm a bit relaxed. But to come to your question, I think quite importantly, we have to differentiate between when we talk about European defense, do we mean EU defense or do we mean, for instance, the European member states of NATO? It's not necessarily the same. And very briefly, I think it's important to state there is and there can only be one single set of forces. So we should give up any thought about specific earmarked European or EU forces that can only be operating under the European hat or the EU hat, as well as considering specific UN forces or NATO forces. Each country have their single set of forces, and then they can, depending on the situation, be working under either organization or the other. It's good to have EU as an alternative to NATO, because we could imagine cases where NATO forces or where NATO and the NATO Council could not agree on employing an operation under the NATO flag. And in such case, it's good to have alternatives. There are other alternatives than just the EU. There is, as I mentioned, the United Nations. There is the so-called JEF. There could be OSCE and many other so-called coalitions of the willing. In my perception, there is no such thing as EU or European capabilities. There are the capabilities of the nations who can be employed under a particular flag, depending on the situation and what the nations can agree on.
Thank you. Benedict, maybe you want to add to that and maybe just identify the core threats and challenges that we're facing in these very trying and very difficult days and years.
Thanks, Kerry. Thanks for having me. Thanks, General, for making me feel overdressed now. I'll pay you back on that one. The topic of European defense has been at the center of what the Munich Security Conference is doing for many years, for decades. And we believe that several things can be true at once. Europe needs to up the game when it comes to defense, but I am with you, General, must not do so in competition with NATO, but in unison, in step with NATO. Second, we have a long way to go. Allow me a little advertising block. If you go on our website, you find something called European Defense Report that goes through combat systems and number of soldiers and the defense budget and so on. And you pretty quickly come to the conclusion that we have almost as many soldiers as the United States. We have almost as many tanks and other systems, but we only have a fraction of the combat power, because whereas the Americans have around 48 battle systems to deal with, we have almost 200 in Europe. You know, there are 17 different types of tanks. I think there are 19 different types of helicopters. I know that Joe Müller from Airbus is here, and you can ask Mike Schallon from Airbus later if that's true and if that's a good thing. But we have a lot of different systems that we have to maintain, that we have to train, that we have to have the logistics on. And by reducing those, we could go a long way in increasing our combat power. I'm with the general. This entire discussion of a European army is totally missing the reality. European defragmentation, European synchronization, those are good things. But dreaming of a European army when basic, questions like who is actually going to give the orders, which language are we going to use, et cetera, until questions like these can be answered, I think we are far better off working on things like decreasing the number of weapon systems, increasing synergies, building up a European defense market, and strengthening NATO.
Yeah, I think we're going to talk about the European army or the idea of the European army a little bit later on, but I think I've gotten a grasp of what your opinion could be on such an idea. And General, now when we're talking about European defense, you've already mentioned we're not really talking about the 27, or if we're taking the countries of the European Union, 27 singular military abilities, but how can we maximize our efforts? How can we collaborate best? And now you've also been deputy commander of a multinational brigade, so you have direct insight into how well does combined military forces, how do they work? And what's your assessment with the multinational brigades that we have in Europe? What can be improved? What's your assessment?
Yes, you're right. And as you also said, there are a wealth of different capabilities and capacities and types of equipment within Europe, but also throughout NATO. And it's actually, in my opinion, not necessarily very complicated to make it work, because at least within NATO, we have so-called standardization. That means many systems are interoperable. It does not necessarily mean they are interchangeable, but they can work according to the same doctrines. They may be using the same calibers of ammunition or the same fuel and so on. So to some extent, it is actually possible to work together in spite of the fact that we do possess very, very many different capabilities. Let me just remind you now, since we are in Germany, that during World War II, the German army alone operated a wealth of different systems. The Americans did so too, and still it was possible to wage war. So having different systems is not necessarily a big challenge. But that said, of course, it would be exceptionally beneficial if we in Europe were able to manufacture and develop something less fragmented than we are today. There are still, but the reason for that is that we waste too many resources between nations and between industries of the nation to protect industries and to develop our own national assets and also to maybe satisfy the customers who want just a slight different model because they believe it fits better for their national purposes. My own country is an example on how we, since many years, always wanted to apply or to buy special versions of equipment because it had to be very special Danish in this aspect or that aspect. We have to get away from that and go in a direction where we can all use the same to a high extent. We have a good example between Germany and Norway, who are developing the same submarine, and it will be the same submarine. And both nations have had to go on compromise on certain national wishes for this kind of submarine. And they accept not to have the 100% ideal solution, but maybe only the 95% ideal solution. And then they can really develop and produce in common. We should do more of that.
That's a perfect lead up for my next question, because I was about to say that military collaboration is not only having multinational brigades, but especially in Europe, especially in the European Union, shared procurement. And I think we've had very good examples on how that can go, for example, with the Eurofighter. I think that's a prime example on how good a product can come from collaboration. Now with FCAS, with the Future Combat Air System, I think we're seeing a few more hiccups and issues on the road. But it's generally a positive example on how we can work together as Europeans. So maybe, Benedikt, you can give us an overview of how good, in your opinion, is European procurement? Maybe touch on PESCO, but just give us your perception.
I think we have improved a lot over the last decade or so. And we've improved a lot in the last 2 years since Zeitenwende was kicked off, not only in Germany, but throughout the alliance. And we have a tendency to always focus on the bad. And, you know, newspapers love writing stories about, you know, how developing a plane takes 43 years and how cumbersome the process is. I think when we look at the ammunition initiatives, recent ammunition initiatives or initiatives on military mobility and enablement, I think we're seeing how Europe can work. When it comes to classic procurement, I think we still have a long way to go. We also have a long way to go because some of the enabling industry just isn't European. It's based in the US or in Israel. And so I'm actually quite happy that we're seeing in Munich and in Berlin and probably in Copenhagen an ecosystem of small startups coming up that can help the Airbuses of this world become even more innovative and shorten production times. I think that's really it, because a lot of people just have an issue with the length of the procurement process. I mean, the professionals know why it is so long, but the public has difficulties following. And if the public has difficulties, it is very difficult for European politicians making the case for European solutions. Because if, you know, there are a lot of people that say, let's buy the American helicopter, we get it next year. We have to make a compromise on a few things, but we have it next year. If we develop a European version, it'll take 10 years. And so I think we need to work on the narrative of procurement, de-negativizing it and making it easier for European politicians to stress the positive aspects. But the executive summary is, and I hope the general agrees, we've come a long way.
Adding to that, if we look at the defense budgets in different European countries, we see that there's a huge variety. So we have countries like Ireland, where we have 0.2% of the GDP. I had to actually look that up again, because I wasn't sure if that was the correct number. And then we have countries like Poland with 4% of their GDP. How does that diversity impact the overall effectiveness of our European defense? And I think the even more interesting question is, how does that affect finding political consensus if some countries are very clearly carrying more of the burden and some countries are underperforming?
You know, and I didn't know that Ireland was 0.2%, but yeah, it is true that all European member states of NATO plus the others have committed in Wales to the 2% target. We can discuss whether this arbitrary number of 2% makes sense, but we've promised that we will spend it, and not all of us are. And I think a few people are waking up to the reality of a potential President Trump 2.0 and his credible threat to make everyone pay or reduce the services. You know, I think we would have believed no one but somebody as disruptive as President Trump that's actually a way to look at an alliance, you know, as a service provider. And I think you will see countries upping the game, not just because of Ukraine, not just because the peer group pressure, but because of the credible threat of Trump and other very conservative Republicans in his group. And so I don't think that Ireland, whatever the actual number is, will get very far by not raising. It's super difficult, particularly now at a time when we try to do so many things at once, you know, push the green transformation, deindustrialization. All these processes cost a lot of money, and there isn't an endless supply of money. So if you want to spend more on defense, something else needs to give. And particularly countries like Germany that has been free riding for many years, but also Portugal that are just far away from all the threats, and probably Ireland as well, will have to reconsider.
General, maybe you want to add?
Yeah, I agree very much on this. I think a lot of countries have increased their defense expenditure. My own country is one of them. Germany is one of them, many others, and you could say the most important or the most big countries have certainly done so. My worry is that if we get a new American administration, maybe the next American president might say, well, now 2% is no longer enough. Now I think it should be 3%. So we could imagine that this person might simply just dislike NATO and want to make things very difficult for NATO. But let's hope that he will stick to the 2%. That's one thing. The next thing is, and that's quite unfortunate that we are so focused on the cash, always on the cash, not so much on the capabilities and the commitment. That is something that my country has been fighting for. Let's also look on how we spend all that money. Because if we spend all the money just on salaries and pensions and healthcare for our military personnel, well, it's not very efficient for any organization, least for NATO or for our national defenses. So it would have been perfect in the perfect world if we had a slightly more nuanced system where we could actually measure the effect of the money we spend instead of just the amount of money we spend. But I think we are on the right path, and I think Europe, the European members of NATO, cannot do much more than they are doing right now to prepare the alliance, but also to prepare for a potential shift in American leadership.
Now, we're at the peak of campaigning right now for the upcoming European elections, and now I have to address the issue that you've already touched on, Benedict. There's a lot of parties who are kind of flirting with the idea of a European army, and that they're suggesting that's the solution to all our problems. We're just going to have one European army, one happy family. That's how we're going to make Europe, up there, up its defense abilities. And I think I have a gut feeling what your answer is going to be. But maybe, Benedict, you want to start. Do you think that's a sensible ambition? Do you think it's realistic? Is it achievable? Should we strive for that? What's your take on that?
See, I think the debate confuses two things. The Europeanization of national militaries isn't the same as a European army or an army of a European Union. And if you look at it, I think we have a huge chance to create, as I've said, synergies. You know, do we really need 17 academies for general staff officers in Europe? Or do we really need, you know, that many training centers for parachutists? Does every country need to have all and every single capability? Or can we say, you know, don't kill me, but, you know, the Scandinavian nations train the admirals together? Or, you know, things like that, that could help us emulate the successful examples of, you know, the German-Dutch brigade or the corps in Poland. Things where we've created synergies and have come out stronger than before. I do see enormous practical difficulties with a European army, but I see enormous opportunities for Europeanized armies on the continent and a logic of cooperation with our British friends. While they've left the European Union, they're still European, and we need to, you know, keep thinking how to include them and do all that without distracting from NATO's primary role in keeping us safe. And I think it's actually all possible, and it actually makes sense, economic sense, military sense. It's just politically not as sexy and as easy to communicate as a European army.
What's your take, General?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, we will, and at least I believe my country will resist any talk of a European army. We don't even have a NATO army. We don't have a UN army. We have the armies or the armed forces of the individual states. And as I said to begin with, they can then decide to pool the forces for any particular operation, and they can have good standardization for doing so. I very much agree. I cannot see any perspective in a European army. But what I can see, and what I think you're talking about, Mr. Franke, is specialization. And this is something that has been debated, at least in NATO, for generations. Why do, as you rightly say, why do necessarily every single member have to have a little of everything, meaning that many has almost nothing of it? Why couldn't some nations specialize in certain capacities and others specialize in others? This in itself is very controversial, and it would mean that it would imply courage from the politicians of those nations to accept, well, we will no longer possess, for instance, submarines, which actually my country decided 20 years ago. We don't have any submarines, although we are the fifth biggest seafaring nation in the world. We simply made that decision. So we rely in the domain of submarines on other partners and allies to deliver that capacity in case we need it one day. And we could allow ourselves to go further that way.
Well, I think I completely agree with the both of you that the path to take is to look for synergies. But the question that kind of keeps popping into my mind when I think of this theoretical construct of a European army is that, in my experience in the German army, you have to have a very strong connection to the country you're serving to be able to do the job as a soldier. You have to be proud. I was proud to be German, to wear the German flag on my sleeve, and I'm sure you're very proud of Denmark, and you're very proud to have the Danish flag on your sleeve. And my question to you would be, do you think that if there should be a European army, is the shared identity that we have as Europeans, is that strong enough that soldiers would not serve under their national flag, under the Italian flag, the French flag, but rather the European flag? So not necessarily a military question, but sense of identity. Is our European identity strong enough to do that?
It depends very much who you ask. First of all, I think most Western armed forces, their soldiers will do what they're told. That's the first, I mean, and as we know, when German soldiers or Danish soldiers or British soldiers are told, now you have to go 6 months to Afghanistan and serve under the flag of NATO, they will do so. So in itself, it's not very controversial. Whether you feel more European than national is very much depending on who you ask. I would say in the northern part of Europe, my own country included, we are more national than we are European. That does not mean don't feel European. But if you ask an average Dane, are you preferably Dane or preferably European? He most likely would say, preferably I'm a Dane. A Brit would certainly say the same. A Norwegian would certainly say the same. A Swede most likely would say the same. A Finn, I believe, would also say the same. But when we get further south, I'm not an expert. Others should answer for that.
Can I?
Sure,
I mean, it's an almost philosophical question. And I have two thoughts on that. In front of every sort of official building in Munich or throughout the European Union, you always find three flags. You find here the Bavarian flag or the Munich flag. You find the German flag. And you find the European flag. And so the question is, do we see enough European flags within European armies to strengthen the identity? I turn the question around. I don't think the identity is strong enough to merit the flag. I think sometimes you need the flag to create the identity. And doing so without distracting from the NATO flag or the national flag, I think is an art that we should focus on more. And there is something called the concentric circles of identity. You can be a proud Copenhagen, a proud Dane, a proud European, a proud Westerner. It's all possible. And I think people don't think like that quite often. They think, you know, things are in competition and we need to hammer that home that they aren't.
So more inclusiveness that can be German, Munich. The question is, is Munich part of Bavaria? I think a lot of Bavarians would agree or disagree with that statement, but we're going to try to be more inclusive with identities. So now we've talked about Europe, the European Union, and now I'd like to go to the interplay between the European Union and NATO. So how do NATO and various EU defense initiatives complement each other? Is there a need for greater integration, separation between these efforts? Maybe Benedict, you want to start, and then General, you can add. How's the situation there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you start from the premise that NATO is the primary alliance to keep us safe, as I think we both agree on, then the question is, what functions for Europe? Why do we need that extra capability? And yes, there could be out-of-area missions that aren't particularly defensive. You know, we've had a decade, or almost two decades, where we thought that out-of-area peace operations were the way to go and regime change was the way to go. That has changed. And so I think sometimes it's not clear what the difference between a NATO mission and a European Union mission is. Again, it's a thing. It's about communication. I mean, the expert know sometimes it's about paying, who pays for things. Sometimes it's double-heading. You're using the same capabilities for two different purposes. Sometimes it's political messaging. You know, it was the European economy that was under threat from piracy, and hence it was a European Union mission that was sent to tackle the problem. It was a political decision. It could have been any type of mission if you'd gotten the votes either at the UN or in the North Atlantic Council. And so that there, at least I believe so, there's very rarely a military rationale behind the decision which flag to use. It's mostly a political.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think also it's very much a question of division of labor now. I think everyone, especially after the Russian attack on Ukraine, has understood now we cannot afford to try and seek for any sort of duplication of efforts and duplication of capabilities. So the division of labor right now, as I see it, is NATO definitely taking care of deterrence and defense along the eastern flank to oppose Russia, and EU then supporting that mission, for instance, by training European soldiers, European defense forces, and EU also taking care of other stuff that the many NATO countries cannot find resources for. For instance, I mentioned the training of the Ukrainian forces, but there are other EU training missions in the world. There are EU maritime missions that is keeping embargo in certain areas. We have along the coast of Somalia. We have outside of Libya and so on. So that there's definitely room and good reasons for EU missions abroad and EU defense operations, as long as it does not compromise the main effort for Europe, at least, to strengthen our posture towards the East. So division of labor here must be the key word.
So before we wrap up, I have one more topic I'd like to cover because it's something that we rarely discuss when we discuss defense, because it's not a necessarily sexy topic, and that's a topic of infrastructure. Because if we talk about military mobility, then we need to have good infrastructure. And especially when I think of Germany, our roads are eroding, our bridges are eroding, and Germany's right in the middle of Europe. So if we're talking about having to move troops and material very quickly, then Germany plays a very important role there. So my question to the both of you is, why have we not understood that investments in resilience and defense, they're not only investments in our military directly, but they're also in our infrastructure, for example, in bridges and roads? Maybe, Benedikt, you want to start?
You know, I think, for better or worse, enablement, military mobility has become a sexy topic, at least in our circles. People couldn't care less about the thickness of bridges for many years. And then suddenly, when Ukraine was invaded, that topic came up on the agenda. There is a new NATO command in Ulm that the Joint Support Enabling Command, run by a German general, who I think is reporting some success, particularly in Germany and in Poland, where the things are usually done at a state or even worse, at a local level. So it's the municipality or the state that is responsible for the bridges, and the question whether there should be a sign in front of the bridge that says, you know, a tank can go this way with that weight and this way with the other weight. Some of you are my age or older, so you remember these signs at bridges. They've almost all disappeared. And it's little things like that. I once asked, when Ben Hodges was still the commander of U.S. Army Europe, what he would love to get from Germany. You know, and I expected something like, I don't know, 25 Patriots or 200 tanks or 5 satellites or something fancy. And he said 4 mobile bridges and an additional pier at Hamburg Harbor reserved for military transport. There is that old saying that amateurs talk tanks and professionals talk logistics. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. If we want to move troops quickly through Central Europe, we need the roads. We need the bridges that can hold them. We need train stations. We need the the fueling stations and all of that, we still have a long way to go on. And people are realizing that. And that is making it more sexy than it used to be, I would say.
Yeah, I fully agree. It's definitely not unsexy to talk about. Actually, it was Ben Hodges who initiated the military mobility because he was stuck in some airport or air station in Hungary a number of years ago, and they couldn't leave the aircraft because their passports were not all right or whatever. But it's definitely important. I mean, Germany is proclaiming your role, rightly so, as Drehscheibe. My own country is also a Drehscheibe. We have to be able to receive, to transit, to secure Allied reinforcements. And we have a long way to go. It's not only the bureaucratic procedures. It's not only the signs on the bridges. It's also the actual infrastructure. We need to have the harbors in place who are big enough to take sufficiently big ships. We need to ensure that all railways across Europe has the same gauge. That means the same width. There are still 400 kilometers of railway in Poland, for instance, who run old Soviet gauge. And therefore, trains coming from Germany or elsewhere cannot pass through Poland along that stretch, those 400 kilometers, which could be vital in case of a war. So there's a long way to go when we talk military mobility. And this is exactly one of the most prominent PESCO projects within the EU, and one that's specifically designed to support also the needs of NATO. So a crucial project. And I would only say, if we don't succeed with that, if we don't succeed in making military mobility, the only alternative is to pre-position all our forces with all their troops and with all their equipment along NATO's eastern flank. And if you follow the debate about the German brigade in Lithuania, you can see how expensive that is going to be for just posting 5,000 troops there. So it's much cheaper to work out good military mobility.
So to finish off, I'd like to take a quick peek in the future. And I know that European defense policy, or to be fair, defense policy in general, is not necessarily playing like Make-A-Wish. It's usually a very difficult process. But if you could voice a couple of key concerns and key projects that we need to get done in the next years to stay resilient, what would be on that priority list? Maybe generally you would like to start.
We need to find a way to find enough hands for our armed forces. Almost all Western society are struggling more and more with available labor to meet our requirements to operate not just our armed forces, but also our whole civil society. So we need to find clever ways of how we can assure enough workforce for our armed forces. That I consider the most serious challenge for the armed forces. One way out of that is conscription, which I know is being heavily debated in this country. We have conscription in Denmark, but it's now debated to increase it. That means to draft more young people, perhaps even women, and prolonging the service time considerably. So that's one way to work around it. And if I'm just going to come with one priority, that is the most important one in my to my mind.
Yeah, absolutely agree. And I think Sweden has just shown how to reintroduce conscription pretty successfully. And it'll be interesting to see whether that plays a role in our federal elections next year. But if I had to pick something in addition to men and women power in the forces, it's really power projection capability. We are having a difficult time getting, you know, a brigade from A to B. We're having a difficult time to then sustain troops in a location for long. And we've signed up to this 30-30-30 plan at NATO, 30 ships, 30, is it brigades or battalions? The amount of people that we've promised that we'll be able to deploy on 30 days' notice, on paper is huge. In practice, knowing the German system pretty well, we are far from that. So power projection and sustainment capabilities, I think, are key.
Thank you. And I think I speak for the audience as well. This has been incredibly insightful. So thank you for taking the time and discussing European defense and European resilience with us. This has been very, very interesting. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening. Did you enjoy the episode? Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer listening to your favorite podcast shows. Forward Thinkers is a 48 Forward podcast produced in the 48 Forward Studios in Munich.